from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After six seasons, Downton Abbey is coming to an end. The lavish British drama, soap opera, became a runaway hit in the United States, the most watched drama in PBS history. Millions of Americans were riveted by the ways and wit and wars of Downton. The aristocracy, the servants and class system, the meticulous costuming, the grand estate, the relentless, disruptive intrusion of the modern, a theme of unstoppable change. And this Sunday, we'll have our last visit upstairs and down. This hour, On Point, goodbye to all that. In the end of Downton Abbey, you can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Were you faithfully there with Lord and Lady Grantham, the servants in the kitchen with Maggie Smith mixing it up? What did you see, learn from Downton Abbey? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us today from Oxford in England is Jessica Fellows, author, journalist. She's written the five official companion books to the Downton Abbey series. Her latest book is a review of all six Downton seasons titled Downton Abbey, A Celebration. She's also the niece of Julian Fellows, the creator, sole writer, and executive producer of Downton Abbey. Jessica Fellows in England. Welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, hello. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's terrific to have you with us today. From Washington, Alyssa Rosenberg joins us. She writes about pop culture for The Washington Post and has just binged back into Downton Abbey. You can link to her terrific reviews and analysis at our website, onpointradio.org. Alyssa, welcome back. Great to have you here.
Always a pleasure.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. It turns out, a big fan of Downton Abbey. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jessica, and Alyssa.
Jack, why are you, have you been hooked on, a fan of this show?
Well, one reason is Maggie Smith. Ever since I saw her years ago in the prime of Miss Jean Brodie, I have been a total fan. And I would watch her read the London phone book. I mean, and in the first season, Matthew Gilbert in the Globe reminded me today, Boston Globe, she got off a zinger almost in the first episode, where she was fine. She's the Dowager Countess, and she says, "What is a weekend?" I mean,
life's a weekend, baby.
You gotta love that.
Jessica, was your crew? I know you had overwhelming viewership in the UK. Something like 20% of Britons watching this show. Were you surprised, I don't know, maybe even astonished at what an enormous 10 million or so, that's big. For PBS, it's huge. For any American show, it's big, that so many Americans would become hooked on Downton Abbey.
Well, I mean, I think we could never have dared to predict that this would be the level of success that it would enjoy. I think we hoped that it would do well, and they certainly felt like they'd put everything into show. I remember that Julian was very excited about it when they were filming it, but the fact that it's gone on to this scale is absolutely unprecedented. I mean, I doubt I'll see anything like this in my lifetime. So it's been amazing to hitch a ride on the Downton train for the last few years.
And kind of amazing the places that this went. I mean, Beyonce supposedly a big fan, Katy Perry a big fan, country singer Tim McGraw says he's a big fan of Downton Abbey. Here he was on a country radio station talking about his Sunday nights with his daughters and Downton.
That's like a big night for the families to sit down and watch Downton Abbey together. And so I'm sitting there with all these girls crying and watching Downton Abbey, and so I start crying too. I have to admit it.
Tim McGraw crying over Downton Abbey, and just a little sound of that. Jack, I don't have your first season, but here's the Dowager Countess, played by Maggie Smith, giving Lady Edith, one of the sisters, of course, played by Laura Carmichael. She's been recently left at the altar, and Maggie Smith, the Dowager Countess, with some no-bull advice.
There must be something you can put your mind to.
Like what? Gardening?
Well, no, you can't be as desperate as that.
Then what?
Edith, dear, you're a woman with a brain and reasonable ability. Stop whining and find something to do.
Maggie Smith is the Dowager Countess laying it down there. Listen, Rosenberg, you say at a certain point you kind of drifted off from this, but you came back, you binged, and you came out of it with a renewed appreciation for Downton Abbey, for, what do you say, the genuine human emotion and the dramas of everyday life, the delicacy with which they're played. You said, frankly, I've been badly craving it, all that in your pop culture, and it's nice to be back on the estate just as it closes up.
Yes, indeed. I think part of what drew me back was Lady Edith, and I'm actually glad that you played that clip, because as I was rewatching the series from start to finish, I had forgotten precisely how off-putting Edith is in early seasons. She is sort of desperate to be married. She chases after men who obviously aren't interested in her. She does something very cruel to her older sister, Mary, who pays her back many, many, many times over. But one of the things that's interesting about the series and that expresses its social message in a sort of subtle way is that all of the things that happened to Edith that at first appear to be catastrophes, getting left at the altar, having a child out of wedlock, ultimately are the things that sort of push her to have a bigger life than she initially imagined. She, when she's jilted, she has to find something to do. She ends up writing a magazine column, and that's how she meets Michael Gregson, who's sort of the first big love of her life, who ultimately is killed in Germany, but leaves Edith both with a child and with the money and business to be independent. Obviously, having a child out of wedlock would be a considerable scandal, but Edith's love for her daughter Marigold, again, sort of pushes her to live with integrity and independence in a way that really makes her kind of a heroic character. I mean, I think she is the person who experiences perhaps the greatest personal growth throughout the series, and I found that very gratifying.
Downton Abbey, of course, starting in April of 1912, the month that the Titanic sank, very consequential for the Crawley family, Lord and Lady Grantham and all the rest, going right through the years of World War I and everything that came along with that, which was a lot, into wrapping up this week, 1925, the year that F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby was published. The first volume of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf was published, into the modern era. But it began, 1912, with the news that word comes that two heirs to the estate, to the Downton Abbey estate, had died in the sinking of the Titanic. Two maids discuss who will inherit the great estate.
But I thought Lady Mary was the heir.
She's a girl, stupid. Girls can't inherit. But now Mr. Crawley's dead, and Mr. Patrick was his only son. So what happens next?
Well, a whole lot happens next. Jessica Fellows has written the companion volumes to this enormous undertaking. Jessica, remind us of the significance of this span of years. So let's just start with the UK. I mean, the whole world got involved ultimately, but 1912 to 1925, and what that meant for the culture where Downton Abbey is rooted.
Well, I mean, the point about why Julian chose to open the series with the sinking of the Titanic was partly because he wanted an iconic moment in history that we could all recognize. So mm-hmm. even if you're not very good at history, you probably know about the Titanic, and you probably know that the first class passengers were treated better than the second class passengers. And so you've got a sense of a class crisis already. And that really sort of sets the tone for the beginning of this world. And just like the Titanic, Downton Abbey, the house, looks so formidable, so impressive. You think that nothing could possibly cause it any concern or worry. There could be nothing that could make those walls crumble. But what, in fact, that age signified was the beginning of really what we would now call the modern age. And the First World War was something that really escalated that. And it was across everything, really. That was what was so extraordinary. It was not just inventions. So you had the Wright brothers first flying a plane in 1910, and by 1925, people were able to take commercial airline travel from London to Paris. And you have, telephones coming in, electricity, then women start to vote. Women are going out to work because so many men were killed in the First World War, so that changed how they were viewed and their roles in society, and they had been all brought up to expect nothing more than marriage, really, and suddenly now they have the opportunity to actually to go out to work and fend for themselves, as we see with Edith, carving out this very interesting life for herself in the wake of what seemed like a very sad event. So it was, it was a phenomenal, phenomenal amount of change, and that's really what Julian's looking at. He's looking at how that happened in the world, but in a house like Downton Abbey, of course, it happens to them much more slowly as they try to take these things on. And I think we have all, maybe subconsciously, we've all really related to this because I think we've gone through something very similar ourselves in the last 15 years. We've had this war fought far away that's affected many of our men in ways that they've not been able to talk to us about easily when they've come home again.
You're talking Iraq, Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that was just the whole point about that First World War, was that it was happening in the trenches in France. It wasn't really happening at home like the Second World War did. So it was this very distant thing, and yet it had this tremendous, tremendous effect. We've had a lot of scientific developments in the way that we communicate. So, you know, in the last 15 years, maybe some of these things, maybe the internet existed, but not at the level that we use it now. So, you know, whether it's Google or Twitter or Skype or, you know, all these means of listening to the radio, people might be listening to this radio, not just through their little radios that they might have had for a long time, but they might be listening to it online. I mean, that's incredible. And it's affected the way that we date and we work, the way that we travel, the Botox, the wider acceptance of gay marriage. You know, there have been big things that have impacted all levels of our society. And I think sometimes when we watch Downton Abbey, I think sometimes we relate to them because we think we either feel like Carson or Violet, you know, rather resisting this bewildering new world and wishing we could get back to the good old days. Or we feel a little bit more like Edith and Rose and Mary and Tom, you know, kind of embracing all of the new opportunities that this kind of thing can bring. So I think that's part of the reason that we've become so engaged in it. And I love the fact that watching the show has turned so many people back to history to find out more. And I do a lot of public speaking events around America, and people often turn up in costume, and you know they can relate to it because they'll often have a little piece they've got by that their grandmother had or their great great aunt owned, or you know it's historical, it's a period drama, but it's not so far away. It's just the beginning of everything that we know now.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the end of Downton Abbey. The series finale is Sunday night. All those years of 19 teens and 20s England about to fade away, we're asking what made Downton so popular among its fans in America. Of course, it was huge in the UK. Jessica Fellows joins us from Oxford, England. She wrote the 5 official companion books to Downton Abbey. Julian Fellows, creator, writer, executive producer of Downton Abbey, her uncle. Alyssa Rosenberg is with us from the Washington Post, writes about pop culture, and just binged again on Downton Abbey and thought it was pretty tasty. Jack Beattie, our own Jack Beattie, On Point News analyst, turns out a big fan, and he's with us as well. You can join us. Why has a tale of lords and ladies, aristocrats and servants been so popular in the USA? If you were a fan, what drew you in? Was it the grand estate, the costumes, the accents, the attitudes, the upstairs-downstairs dynamic? Headbands and wonderful dresses and great parties and galas. I mean, it starts with carriages, moves to cars, telegrams, moves to telephones. Season 1 of Downton Abbey, the butler, Carson, played by Jim Cutler, comforts Lady Mary, played by Michelle Dockery. She's upset because a visitor to the house with whom she slept with last night, a brief affair, has unexpectedly died.
We're all behind you, my lady. The staff. We're all on your side.
Thank you, Carson. You've always been so kind to me. Always. From when I was quite a little girl. Why is that?
Even a butler has his favourites, my lady.
Ah, those touching inter-class moments from Downton Abbey. Jack Beattie, speak, you're a historian yourself. Speak to the cultural and political arc of evolution in the years that this show has covered.
Well, that scene shows something, the end of a sort of feudal ethic, loyalty up. And I think the series, Mr. Fellows, really does show a good deal of loyalty down. I mean, we see again and again Lord Grantham making gestures, trying to keep people in work, doing what he can. But that system of loyalty up from the bottom, loyalty down from the top, was under threat, great economic pressure. And if there's a great fault in the series, it's the lack of any talk of money, really, or of the economic pressure. I mean, to put it bluntly, Kansas was and had been for a generation putting agriculture in the United Kingdom out of business. You just couldn't compete with it.
The estates with their lands and their crops that were up against the American ag surge.
Just couldn't do it. And still, though, you had the estate standing. In 1914, about 4,000 individuals still really controlled 50% of all the privately owned land in England. And yet the land they were on was worth less and less, and they were having to squeeze their employees and lay them off and squeeze their tenants and sell bits of their land. And the inexorable economic pressures of globalization then were doing them in.
And change had to come. I mean, Alyssa Rosenberg, you write so wonderfully, I think this has just come out today, but about how when we look back on our past, whatever they are, we want to be, you say, reassured about what we've left behind us, to be buoyed by the idea that our forebears displayed the vision and moral fortitude to embrace the great changes advancing upon them. We don't want to imagine that they made accommodations that would allow new eras to sweep over them, disguising their prejudices in order to keep believing in those prejudices and holding on to their privileges with a tight grasp. What does Downton Abbey tell you about its treatment of those dynamics?
Well, I think one rap on Downton Abbey has been that it's a series where people always talk about how much the world is changing, but their lives don't actually seem to change very much. And I disagree to a certain extent that the show doesn't mention economics, and certainly a big theme of this season has been the shrinking of the servant class, ways to make estates pay, etc. So I think there's a little bit of that there. But one of the things that I think is both off-putting to people occasionally when they watch Downton Abbey and true is that social change progresses rather slowly. And movie biopics and sort of historical movies have trained us to expect that all of our characters in the past will be in the vanguard of social, political, economic change, that they'll be sort of early adopters of new ideas and new customs, that they will be the ones at the barricades and forcing change to happen. When in reality, political change reaches most people fairly slowly, right? If you don't live in a city where changes in style or the way people live and interact with each other are being pioneered, it might take years or even a decade for those changes to reach out to you. And so while it's true that on Downton Abbey we'll see something like a phonograph or a hairdryer, people's lives change fairly slowly. I mean, this is a series that covers 13 and a half years, I think. And, you know, we see something like Joseph Molesley's bookishness early in the series when he's trying to, you know, make his fumbling attempts at courting Anna Bates. But it's not until this season that we see him fully realize that interest in learning when he becomes a school teacher. In a similar way, in the second season, Cora is very sort of anxious about the possibility of Downton being used as a recovery facility for wounded officers. But she sort of gets a taste for the work and ultimately this season finds, you know, sort of an outlet for that when she becomes the president of the local hospital. Mm-hmm. And so there are one of the things I think was actually impressive and that I don't know that Julian Fellowes always got credit for was planting the seeds of these sort of eventual transformations. And, you know, this is how people's lives actually work. It takes a long time to self-actualize. And I think that television is actually better suited to telling those sorts of stories than the movies, because the movies have to focus on the short period when everything changes and on the period on the people who brought about change. Television shows have a little bit more breathing room to acknowledge that most people change fairly slowly. And I think Mad Men did the same thing.
Yeah. Here's a little bit. You mentioned Joseph Molesley in seasons 5 and 6, the unassuming sort of Crawley House servant, played by Kevin Doyle. He begins teaching at the Downton School. You can hear attitudes and class lines in motion, moving from servant to teacher.
I'm a teacher now, but I'm an ordinary bloke. I've spent my life in service, fetching and carrying.
You were a servant?
I was. I am. And I was glad to get the work. But I never gave up on learning, do you see? I read as much as I could, and I taught myself. And I hope to be able to teach you. maybe give you the shortcut that I never had.
The world opening up for one servant there. Jessica Fellows, how did this play in the UK on that front? Did it look like a dramatization of earthquake change going on, or was it more about comfort in the old ways and old days?
For the English, they definitely watch Downton Abbey slightly differently to the Americans or indeed the rest of the world, because it does feel more personal. It's more of a, you know, a comment on our own history, as opposed to watching some strange people do their strange things on a, you know, small island far away. I think with Maudsley, you know, his storyline for me was very touching and very important, and similar to Daisy's in that it brought out, you know, what a difference education can make. And that's something that, you know, we're definitely discussing a lot in Britain at the moment in terms of whether we're giving the right education to our children. And what was very significant about it then was that it was the first time after the First World War that the working classes believed that they were allowed to have different opportunities, you know, that they might have be able to do different things.
Mm-hmm.
There was this, you know, it wasn't that they didn't get frustrated before or that certain people didn't kind of buck the trends that were there, but there was very much this mindset that if you were born into a certain area, if you're born into the rural part of the world, there were really only two choices in life. You went into farming or you went into service. And service was seen as kind of, you know, very good because although it was very long hours, you had very little time to yourself.
You mean service to a great household, for example?
Yeah,
a servant.
A great household. Mm-hmm. It might be for a small household. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, many households employed mm-hmm. servants at mm-hmm. that time.
So yep.
But obviously, to be a servant in a great household was deemed to be very successful because there was something quite attractive and fun about it. You got this window into this world because don't forget, when you're the servant, you're up. That, you know, when you get to go up the stairs, or even if you're still downstairs in the kitchen, you hear all the stories about this very grand life. And it's like their own little soap opera that's going on. That's how they would kind of entertain themselves. That's what they would talk about. I had a wonderful story about a butler who said he liked his favourite pastime was piecing together letters that had been torn up and thrown in the waste paper basket. You know, so you know that's kind of what, you know, that's what they were doing. But the point about working in service was that you had a roof over your head. You were given three meals a day. You had colleagues, and also you had the opportunity to. For promotion, you know, you could better yourself, and you might, as you got promoted, you might be able to go and work in other houses, and so you would travel a little bit more, and so on.
But always within a distinctly lower class. Always, always, always.
Yeah. You always would have been lower class. Yeah. You were never, ever going to get to go up those stairs.
Yeah.
And you never were going to go and run a business or, you know, do anything. And then suddenly after the First World War, you know, there were fewer servants. Many of those who had come back from war had seen a very different way of life. And then obviously with transportation, the growth of the middle classes, the growth of urban areas, even new technology meant that new jobs were suddenly becoming available. And suddenly it was, you know, could I actually do that? Could I try and do something else? Maybe they were forced mm-hmm. into it. Maybe there wasn't the work there. But that change in mindset was such a significant thing to happen. And I think lots of people watching it here in Britain knew that their grandparents or great-grandparents had been in service, and they know they live very different lives now to their great-parents, their grandparents. And that really only came about because suddenly the notions of equality started to be discussed after the First World War properly. I mean, there have been rumblings of it in the Victorians, and we mustn't dismiss the Victorians for what they did, but it was just that the First World War escalated everything suddenly very quickly, and then it became very apparent that the change really had now happened.
Jessica Fellows, Alyssa Rosenberg, Jack Beattie, I want to turn to our callers. North Carolina, Elizabeth City, Pat is calling. Hi, Pat, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom, hi. I'm calling because I'm a great fan of Downton Abbey. I love the gentility of the manners shown between the characters and upstairs and downstairs. I love the clothing, just beautiful, beautiful gowns, and I love the dressing for the dinners. And it seemed that they were, even though the servants downstairs certainly lived a much different life than those upstairs, they seem to care about one another. There seemed to be such a fondness, a relationship that the upstairs and the downstairs really enjoyed. And it's interesting to me that on the opposite channel is the, at the same time, is the fabulously popular The Walking Dead. And what an antithesis of Downton Abbey when there seemed to be such a respect for womanhood and respect for the way things were done in those days, that it wasn't dog-eat-dog, even if they didn't like each other. Maggie Smith was wonderful. Even if she didn't like the other person, she certainly had a way of putting them down in such a genteel way that you had to really appreciate it. And how could you get mad at someone who talked to you like that? It's just absolutely wonderful. And I'm just so sad that it's ending. And I hope that something just as good from the British will take its place, because they're just lovely, lovely accents and the countryside and, of course, the great manor house. The one we have in North Carolina, of course, it's not even close, but it's what we have as an American castle is the house called Biltmore.
Of course, the Vanderbilt House.
North Carolina, you may have heard of that.
Yes, of course. Famous and amazing in its own scale. Pat, I love your rendition of the show right here. It's kind of a narrative in itself, and I appreciate your raising it. I mean, Jack Beatty, there's Pat thinking about what Downton Abbey in her neck of the woods has been on at the same time as The Walking Dead, a zombie show, where it's human eat or zombie eat zombie or whatever it is. I mean, there was something hopeful, even with all the class tensions and this, you can hear the pleasure and the elegance in the countryside. You can get lost in that.
Yes, and the gentility, she uses just the word. And of course, Maggie Smith as the as sort of the princess of zingers. One another one, principles are like prayers. Noble, of course, but awkward at a party. Gotta love that writing.
Alyssa, what about the appeal to this American audience of this grand English setting? I guess it comes back again and again, but I keep thinking maybe we're done with that, and then we're not.
Well, I mean, I think that we don't experience any of the downsides of having a hereditary nobility, and so we can be fascinated by it from afar. And I think that Downton Abbey is not the only British cultural artifact to benefit from that. I think the American obsession with, formerly Kate Middleton is sort of a perfect example of that. And so it's very easy to admire the clothes and the grand houses, but we don't have to live with any of the social, political, or economic consequences of having a monarchy or hereditary nobility. Not that we don't have our own viciously stratified class system. And I do wonder if sometimes we look at, you know, upstairs, downstairs stories set in Britain and wish that our own class system was more genteel and that there was more of a sense of responsibility by the 1% or wherever you want to draw the cutoff for the other 99%. So I think it's both a fantasy that lets us sort of dabble in something that we might not actually really want if it was on offer, and lets us imagine that our own stratifications could be kinder and gentler. I will say, though, I mean, I think the caller's enthusiasm for sort of the clothes and the gentility of Downton Abbey open up what I think is a potential line of critique for the show, which is that it only rarely shows the really, really harsh consequences that people suffered in this system. And, you know, the story of Ethel Parks is kind of an interesting counterpoint to that that she didn't mention. Ethel is a housemaid at Downton Abbey who sort of wants more and has this ill-advised affair with one of the officers who's convalescing at Downton. She ends up having a child out of wedlock, descends into incredibly extreme poverty, and ends up as a prostitute. Lady Edith, by contrast, has a child out of wedlock and yet manages to find a way to maintain her respectability and find, you know, meaningful work. So it wasn't all genteel and fun and games.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the end of Downton Abbey. Sunday night, the big series finale. All those years of 19-teens and 20s England about to go off into Downton Abbey land, into the mist. And we're asking what made Downton so popular among its fans in the United States. Alyssa Rosenberg is with us. Culture critic for The Washington Post, Jessica Fellows, is with us from Oxford, England. She's the niece of Julian Fellows, creator, writer, executive producer of Downton Abbey. She's also written 5 official companion books, author and journalist in her own right, to the show. Our own news analyst, Jack Beattie, is here, and you can join us. Have you been a stone-cold fan of Downton Abbey? Did you feel the tumult of change sweeping through those years? Are we living through a chapter like that now? How deep did you get into the Downton mania? Tell us, what's the moment, the feeling that will last for you from Downton Abbey? Here's just one of the love storylines in the show between Lady Sybil Crawley and Tom Branson, an Irish Republican. Firebrand, sometimes who worked for the Crawleys as a chauffeur. Here in season 2, frustrated Tom uses politics to provoke Sybil, played a daughter of the great estate, played by Jessica Brown Findlay, and suggests that she'd given up her cause, the suffragist movement, during World War I. He's talking about politics, but the subtext here is love. They're cross-class lines, love.
Sometimes the future needs terrible sacrifices. You thought that once.
If you mean my politics, you know we've agreed to put that to one side until the war is won.
Your lot did. But Sylvia Pankhurst was all for fighting on. Oh,
don't badger me, please.
Sometimes a hard sacrifice must be made for a future that's worth having.
There we are. Jack Beattie, did you see a parallel universe here to our own years and times and dimensions of change?
Well, I thought Alyssa really put her finger on it, that we see an idyllic inequality where there's a good deal of tenderness for those at the bottom. But the inequality is more or less frozen. Yes, education may be a ladder for some, but few. And people accept their station, more or less. And so it's a kind of, maybe there's a sort of reactionary romance in this. It sort of makes Americans think, well, maybe we could all live with our own, aristocratic society. I mean, all the Republican candidates, for example, want to eliminate entirely the estate tax, which would be great news for Downton Abbey.
Yes, absolutely. Nope, on goes the manse. Yeah, no question. Let's get our listeners in Buffalo, New York. Susan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I think the Americans in general have a fascination with the wealthy, wanting to know how the other half lives. And also, we have a fascination with royalty. Anything that has to do with the royal family, marriages, births, I mean, everyone in the United States is glued to their TV set. And I think that's part of the draw for Downton Abbey. It encompasses both. It illustrates how the wealthy live, and it also adds a touch of royalty because they do have titles. And in addition to that, the acting, the character, writing is just superb.
Susan, do you think it's that fascination with the wealthy, even now when there's so many people riled up and stomping around about the 1%, the 0.0001% in the United States?
They may not like them, but they're still fascinated by them.
Yeah, I think you've got that right. I appreciate your call. Another from Detroit, Michigan. Greg, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to thank you all for the program. It brought back to me the fact that I watched Upstairs, Downstairs in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
And the impact that it had on me was the fact that I realized that downstairs they spoke a certain English, and upstairs they spoke another English.
Yes.
So it really encouraged me to learn English. And learn it well, and I don't speak, as I've been told most of my life, that I don't speak at all the way I look.
So you stepped it up on the language front, and did it change your life, Greg?
Completely. Absolutely, completely.
That's a real life
Downton
lesson.
Downton Abbey, yeah. And Downton Abbey is like the second... I actually thought it was Upstairs, Downstairs. I tuned in for the first time, not knowing what I was watching. And I was like, wow, Upstairs, Downstairs is back on.
And you have taken a life lesson that we can hear and that has changed your life. Greg, I so appreciate your call. Jack Beattie, take us back to Upstairs, Downstairs. You remember probably what a big impact that had in American culture. This introduction for many Americans to the sort of nitty-gritty of class in the UK. What about that versus Downton Abbey, the treatment?
Well, for one thing, that was London, right? Mm-hmm. That was an urban setting, and the raw realities of London life could come in. And there were some tough episodes there, as I remember. And maybe there was some more. There was more class tension, at least as I remember it. And also a kind of broader comedy that was in there. But Greg's point is just a fascinating one. It reminds me of a line of George Orwell. He said, "Workers of the world unite! You have nothing to lose but your H's."
The way you speak.
The way you speak. Yes. And what? How important that is for mobility. The counters. The insignia. The semaphores of class. At one point, Maggie Smith is talking about a man who doesn't have much money. She says, but he does shoot, doesn't he?
Yeah. Oh, well, a man who shoots, well, then that's something.
There you go.
It's funny because I had many friends who were so into it. It just never really made my screen, but I've heard the conversation through all these seasons and seen those who are. Paolo in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Paolo, you're on the air.
Hi. I am a opposite of a fan of Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
I got forced into watching it with my wife. And the class issue, I loved Upstairs Downstairs as a product of its time, and Duchess of Duke Street. And it just drove me crazy. Jane Austen novels, it was written at the time, so the context, you have to take it with that. But this is written now, and I feel like it's such a failing in the sense that they aren't talking about the tough stuff. You play the clip about Ireland, about the IRA,
yep.
And there's no discussion about it. It just is a small little thing. And I feel like it's a disservice to us as viewers. But my larger point, I guess, would be the reason why I dislike it so much is that it's kind of, voting against your interest. It's liberals who want to be Lord of the Manor. That kind of attitude towards it.
You think it boils down to that? That it boils down to kind of a fascination with the boot, the oppressor. I don't know.
Completely agree with that. Yeah, and the PBS did that or did a show where they had a virtual or a reality TV show where they did a manor kind of thing.
Yeah,
and everybody they got to play. They took the social roles that they had before, and then they just mimicked that in the show, so they ended up with the same process. And I think it is this, it's like Dallas for the liberals.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I definitely would not want to be down in the kitchen, but it is interesting the sympathy with which it is written toward the whole scene. I've got a little bit, Jessica Fellows, of your uncle, Julian, of course, again, creator, sole writer of Downton Abbey. Here he's talking about the influence that his, perhaps your own family had and the stories that came down on how he wrote about the intimacy of the relationship between servants and aristocrats in Downton Abbey. Here's Julian Fellows.
What I got from them was that sense with some servants of that kind of interdependence and sort of friendship that, some people deny ever existed. Oh, this is so sensible. Nobody was ever nice to their lady's maid, But of course that's nonsense. I mean, how could you be dressed and undressed every day of your life by someone you disliked?
Well, I suppose it's possible. It wouldn't be fun. Jessica Fellows, what about you hear the critique from a listener here saying, and Jack as well, that this reactionary romance, and this does not convey just how tough it could be.
Well, yes, I think, people like to think that there's been a bit of a rose-tinted look at the past. I think what's difficult is that, well, first of all, what Julian was writing was a TV drama, not a documentary.
Yep.
So they worked incredibly hard from the art department to make things look as authentic as possible so that you could trust in the details and therefore trust in the bigger picture too. And much of what Julian did drew from real life, whether it was stories and characters from the family or whether it was historical events that were happening at that time, there's the mix-up. But at the same time, it's one family and he needs us to tune in week after week. So a lot more happens to the Crawleys than you would hope happens to anyone else. And, Anna and Bates, are very nice, decent couple. And so because you can't have them being happy and nice every week, we have to have terrible obstacles thrown in their way, you know, with regularity. But the rose-tinted argument doesn't really wash with me, only because, first of all, we did see some pretty hideous elements of life. I would not go back to what some people call the good old days. When you look at Thomas's life, you know, and how he could never free to be who he really wants to be and to love who he really wants to love. We saw Sybil die in childbirth, which was much, much more common then than it is now, thanks to medical advances. We see Ethel have to give her child up in order for her child to have, you know, a proper start in life, and she's not able to raise a child by herself. It would, you know, it would bring too much shame and so on. Edith is not able to reveal, you know, the truth about Marigold. And, you know, all of these things are depicted within the storylines. And when it comes to the masters and the servants, in fact, you did get a lot of good relationships. Just as now you are, there are bad bosses and there are good bosses. On the whole, what everybody understood back then was you were living under one roof, and life is a lot nicer if you just got on. Well, they weren't necessarily great friends with their servants. But I think Julian tries to show that the servants know much more about the family than the family knows about the servants. There was a wonderful scene where Mary has spent all night mucking out the pigs with Charles Blake, you know, getting very muddy and everything. And she takes him into the kitchen at the end of a very long night and cooks him scrambled eggs as a way of showing him, you know.
This is the daughter of the great family. Yeah.
She's sort of trying to show that she can be, you know, not, you know, kind of down with it, you know, in the kitchen and everything. And then right at the end, one of the servants walks into the kitchen and Mary realizes she doesn't know her name and is embarrassed by that.
Both sides.
So would put these moments in. But what often happened with servants and masters is that when it was just the two of them in the room, so if it's just the mistress and the lady's maid, then they could be quite relax around each other. The servant would only be relaxed to a degree. I mean, a servant would never sit down in the presence of the family. Doesn't matter how well you know them. And Anna never, ever, the lady's maid, has never sat down in the presence of Mary except when they were in a completely other situation, when they went to the doctors in London. It just would have looked mad for Anna to stand up. But, you know, she never sits down, no matter how much they're confessing to each other. But you would have a kind of fairly relaxed conversation. But then if somebody else comes into the room, you revert to absolute formality. So they were just trying to allow servants to be professional and get on with their work. So they wouldn't knock on doors. They would walk in and out of rooms, you know.
Just get on. I don't know. But don't sit down. Don't speak to me in a natural way in the presence of anybody else. I mean, we get it. We're talking about the end of Downton Abbey. One more call here. Allegra in Weymouth, Massachusetts. Allegra, you're on.
So I was interested to hear that Julian Fellowes said that he had to stop the story at the point in which he chose because so many things had been written and filmed about the Second World War. But I think he has to stop them because of the sympathies of the British upper class and the Nazi regime. You know, it would be too ugly to expose the truth of that. And I've never heard anyone address this fact.
Jack Beattie, how about it?
Well, that's a broad brush, I think. You know, some of the strongest people, for example, I think Lady Astor was one of the strongest voices against appeasement. On the other hand, there was the famous Cliveden set. The people were very soft on Hitler and so on. But it's a broad brush to say that the upper classes as a whole were, the Mosleyites or whatever the British fascist group was called. Certainly it had some elements in it, but I don't know that the facts bear out a whole class feeling that way. On the other hand, you know, your English aristocrat was in 1936 was probably more worried about Bolshevism than Nazism, and for good reason.
And this from Jack Beattie, who's out with a new play, I should remind everybody. Munich, The Battle Not Begun, 1938. Reading of it this weekend. Look forward to that. You say, Alyssa Rosenberg, for all that Downton Abbey depicts a sumptuous way of life in decline, the show does not mourn the past. You find something hopeful and admirable in that.
I do, and I think it's notable that in the series, embracing social change and moving outside of existing roles is very much linked to self-improvement and sort of sympathy in characters. And so, you know, Edith's willingness to move beyond the very, you know, straight-laced role that was prescribed for her is also what makes her a better person. You know, Moseley's courage in trying to imagine a different sort of life for himself and self-improvement makes him much more sympathetic than when he was complaining about lowering himself to do hard labor and road work. And so we see again and again that there is this relationship between embracing social change and self-actualization and personal liberation. And it's subtle, it's not revolutionary, but it's definitely there.
Couldn't be more apt that for our time. Alyssa Rosenberg at the Washington Post, wonderful to have you with us. Will you be watching Sunday night as it all wraps up, Alyssa?
I've already seen the finale, but I'm not spilling any secrets.
The critic is ahead of everybody. Alyssa, thanks so much for joining us. Jessica Fellows, author, journalist, author of all the companion books to Downton Abbey, joining us today from Oxford, England. Thank you so much, Jessica, for being with us.
Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure.
And Jack Beattie, thank you, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can keep in touch with On Point. Sign up for our new Week in the News newsletter at our website, onpointradio.org. This week, we are digging into our shows on cocktails, Downton Abbey, and the rising power of American single women. Check it out at onpointradio.org. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. We're there at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.